Today in Europe, this is the time of day when the Columbia Broadcasting System brings you news from abroad. And now this is Bob Trout in New York about to call in CBS representatives for their reports direct from Europe. But first, a brief summary. A report out of Ankara tonight that Great Britain and France agreed to advance Turkey $240 million in credits in return for that mutual assistance agreement signed the other day. But there is no official confirmation of this. Much speculation out of Moscow about a possible new move in the Balkans by the Soviets. Speculation aroused by the editorial in the Moscow newspaper Izvestia, which says that Great Britain and France have failed to drive a wedge between Russia and Germany, and which adds further that Turkey and Russia could not make an agreement which would be compatible with the treaty Turkey has made with Britain and France, and which warned that Russia is keeping a vigilant eye on the Black Sea. Nothing much new from the Western Front. Paris says there's little change in the positions of the opposing troops, but tells about French artillery fire, which was said to be harassing German rear and front-line detachments. Some patrol activity also reported, but otherwise mud and overflowing streams were said to have slowed down the operations. The tally out of London still is 3 German warplanes downed in that raid upon a British warship convoy and British merchant ships. 3 down out of the 12 attackers. No British ships hit or damaged. British War Secretary Horbelascha addressed the British people by radio today and said that Great Britain must watch out and resist German peace efforts, which he called specious. He says a German mass attack in the West would bring heavy casualties in the German forces. And now, let's hear Europe direct. First, Germany, where diplomatic activity is so intense, some correspondents are calling it feverish. German Chancellor Adolf Hitler confers with an ambassador, calls party leaders to Berlin, amid rumors of conferences with representatives of just about every nation which could be considered friendly to the Third Reich. For the latest word from Berlin, here's the report of CBS representative William L. Shirer. Go ahead, Berlin.
Good evening, this is William L. Shirer in Berlin. A lot of people in this town tonight have apparently decided to forget the war and their own troubles. The cafes and bars and nightclubs are full. Driving the blackout, I made a little tour of inspection on my way out here to the studio. Berlin's West End, where most of the places of amusement are located, was crowded. It's pitch black outside tonight, but the Kurfürstendamm, which in the bygone days of peace was Berlin's Great White Way, was jammed with people. They made their way along good-naturedly, shining their flashlights at the entryways to the cafes and the night places until they found the one they were looking for. You're not allowed to use your car to go to a movie or a cafe or any place of amusement like that. That's verboten. So the people take the subway or elevated or streetcar or bus, usually to the zoo, which is in the center of the West End, and from there they walk. It was very hard going in that vicinity tonight, so jammed were the streets and the dark. No doubt the fact that it was Saturday night partly explained the crowd, but also the fact that what with the blackout and the food cards and the feeling that there is no end of the war in sight, people were taking Saturday night off to celebrate a little and relieve the strain. Not that these people had not read in their newspapers today that things were going very well for Germany in this strange war that nobody understands. They were told, for example, in the press today that Mr. Gustav Anderson of Illinois, and Mr. Anderson is certainly the man of the hour here today, had finally, in a sworn statement in Washington, decisively proved that Mr. Churchill and not a German U-boat had sunk the Athenia. And if you think people here don't believe Mr. Anderson, as quoted in the German press, you would be making a mistake. For them, the Athenia incident is closed, and Mr. Churchill sank the boat. Then, in some of the afternoon papers, they read the leading story, which was that Secretary of State Hull was going to make a diplomatic demarche in London about the British stopping American mail to Germany. Well, thought the average German, it was about time. At last, America was waking up to the ways of the British. And there was another story about the mounting success of German warships, both submarines and ordinary craft, against enemy shipping. Here, too, the war was going well, the paper said. From October 13th to October 15th, 7 enemy boats sunk, 54,000 tons of shipping destroyed. And this success, the paper said, was mounting, not the contrary. The convoy system, for example, it was explained, was not as safe as Mr. Churchill said. German naval ships, it went on, were certainly causing great concern in London. You couldn't call that bad news for Germans. And if no mention of submarine losses has ever crept into a German paper, why, well, I don't think many people have thought about that. And then to continue the good news, starting Monday, more butter was to be rationed out and less margarine. Starting Monday, almost a quarter of a pound of butter per person per week, and a little less than that of margarine. And another item, the families of soldiers were to get more financial aid from the state. In some cases, as much as the man who now is in uniform earned. That took the load off many a family. As a matter of fact, there was no bad news in the papers at all, as people laid down their work this Saturday night. Of course, there was that Turkish pact with Britain and France, but didn't nearly every Berlin paper play up the fact that the chief newspaper of Soviet Russia today, the Izvestia, itself frowned upon the Turkish pact and said that any attempt to disturb the present German-Russian friendship was useless? Didn't the Izvestia agree with the German press that the Turkish pact was not an instrument of peace and that Turkey was playing with fire? And then there was that item of human interest that Herr Hitler received the Slovak minister in Berlin today and informed him that Slovakia would receive back the territories taken from it by Poland in 1920, 1924, and 1938. Wasn't that being just and generous? No, the people here could well afford to spend a pleasant Saturday night in a cafe knowing that things were going all right. I did notice one thing this evening in one of the big hotels. Its lobbies were full of party leaders in the provinces, apparently summoned to Berlin. But why they were summoned, I don't know. I return you now to Columbia in New York.
That was Berlin. Now the news from London, where the British War Secretary reported to the British public by radio today. A report now by the chief of Columbia's European representatives, Edward R. Murrow. Go ahead, London.
This is London. For the first time, so far as is known in London, a British convoy of freighters has been attacked from the air. According to tonight's report, the convoy system, an effective defense against submarines, has met its first test from the air successfully. The raid on the flotilla of slow-moving freighters and their escort of warships apparently took place not far off the English coast in the North Sea. The sound of heavy gunfire was heard by people on the Lincolnshire coast. Reports indicate that the German raiders made two attempts to attack the convoy. This morning they were spotted by the convoy, which sent radio calls for help. A number of British fighting planes then drove the attackers off. The German planes returned in the afternoon. In a joint statement, the Admiralty and the Air Ministry announced that 12 German planes descended on the convoy. British fighting planes immediately engaged them. The statement says that at least 3 German planes were brought down, while a 4th raider, subjected to intense fire, was forced to land at sea. None of the British aircraft sustained casualties, says the official statement, and no freighter or escort vessel of the convoy was damaged. The announcement concludes with the statement that not all reports have yet been received. From all the news reaching London, it can be ascertained that the Germans have lost 1/4 of their planes each time an attacking force has come over. Some military experts have told me that a nation at war could not afford an average loss of more than 10% of its attacking aircraft. The Germans, according to British figures, have been losing about 25%. Mr. Horbelicia, the Secretary of State for War, broadcast to Britain tonight. He saw 3 courses open to Germany. To try and smash through by land, sea, and air. To remain quiescent in the hope that Britain would prematurely launch an offensive. Or to lure the Allies into the discussion of specious peace terms. Germany would pay dearly for any massed attack upon the Maginot Line, said Mr. Horbelicia. The Allies would choose their own time for attack and would not risk armies unnecessarily. But it was the third alternative, the discussions of peace, about which Britain must be most carefully on guard, said the war minister. No peace proposals, which rely for their sanction on a broken word, can be considered, he said. We are concerned with the frontiers of the human spirit. This is no war about a map, was another phrase. Time, he said, was on the side of the Allies. The Secretary of State for War is not alone in his concern about a German peace offensive. Today's Evening Standard has this to say. What will happen in England if winter comes but no land offensive? It may be that we shall have to suffer
have to suffer the boredom, the blackout, and the bureaucrats without any compensating excitement. It may be that when the peace parties will, that then the peace parties will raise their heads again. They will ask, why continue with a war which our enemy does not wish to fight? That is precisely what Hitler wants them to ask. Peace this winter, with his Polish conquest safely garnered, ranks even above his army as the instrument by which he may yet escape from his present corner and prepare for the march toward the domination of Europe. Mr. David Lloyd George made a speech today, too. He renewed his demand for a conference. You can be firm at a conference as well as on the battlefield, he said. A peace conference today would no longer be a Munich, with its unready forces and its shivering diplomats bullied and whipped by the German dictator. We could quit the conference if Hitler showed that he meant to cling to his conquest, said Mr. Lloyd George. He denied that he was a peace at any price man. Britain was not a beaten nation. Far from it. He wanted closer contact with Russia. If a conference was called and collapsed, the whole world would then blame Hitler, according to Mr. Lloyd George. Today was registration day in England for the group of army conscripts between the ages of 20 and 22. 215,231 registered today. Of this number, 2 1/10% declared that they were conscientious objectors against fighting. 3,728 of these boys were drawn from England, 435 from Scotland, 393 from Wales. A total of 4,556 who declined to become combatants. They will eventually appear before examiners who will investigate their claims for exemption. Britain is now at the end of the seventh week of the war. Many aspects of the situation are not clear. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between military and diplomatic moves. The military moves can be charted on the maps, but I've seen no map which portrays the diplomacy and the propaganda, no flags or arrows indicating the lines of this war, or it's being fought all over the world. Everything is possible, but nothing is likely, is about the best short summary I've heard of the present position. I return him now to Columbia in New York.
We've heard the report from London of the unprecedented attack on the British warship convoy of cargo ships by German warplanes. The war, stalled on land, goes on at sea. Now to discuss the military and naval aspects of the war, here is CBS expert Major George Fielding Elliott. Major Elliott.
In this period of hesitation, perhaps the lull before the storm, it may be well to recall, from the British viewpoint at least, this is something more than a localized European war. Britain has a vast empire to think about. She has available the resources of that empire for her support, while her fleet continues, as it has for centuries, to command the sea routes by which those resources may reach the British Isles. But she must also remember the need for imperial defense. It is for this reason that the conclusion of the Turkish Pact has been hailed with such especial rejoicings in Britain. Englishmen see in Turkey a powerful ally commanding strategic positions in the Near East, standing across the path of any revival of the old German Drang nach Osten, the march to the east, to the oil fields of Iraq, and the headwaters of the Persian Gulf. But this is a remote danger, perhaps, one whose accomplishment may well be impossible. A more immediate danger to the empire may be Soviet Russia. Russian troops on the Caucasian frontier menace Iraq as well as Turkey. Russian machinations in Afghanistan menace the northwest frontier of India at a time when much of the Indian army is absent in distant lands. The arrival of a Russian military mission at Chongqing perhaps foreshadows new Russian aid to China, which can be the more readily forthcoming because of Russia's new comparative security in Europe. A Bolshevized China would be a threat not only to India, but to all the hopes now entertained in London of reviving the once lucrative British trade with China. For the immediate moment, it might be an offset to possible Japanese aggression in the Far East, but in the long view, Britain could hardly regard such a development with complacency. It should not be forgotten that in British conservative circles, there still exists an almost hysterical fear of communism, together with a very real anxiety as to the future of British trade in the whole of the Orient. These may be important factors in the future decisions of the British government, as they have undoubtedly been in the past. It is at the center, however, of the sea power, which is the mainstay of the empire, that Germany strikes when she employs her air and submarine forces against British naval ships and bases. The attacks so far have been rather experimental than of a decisive character. though their results have been ominous. There are now current reports that disputes are in progress between the Army and Navy in Germany as to whether it is worthwhile to continue these operations on a larger scale, as the Navy contends, or whether a greater proportion of the Air Force should be employed to support the Army on the Western Front. If the reports are true, the outcome of this argument, said by the Paris Figaro to have been already won by the Army, may have far-reaching consequences as to the future conduct of the war. Meanwhile, note may be taken of the repeated reports that Germany has available a far larger number of submarines than had been officially admitted. Some estimates running as high as 200. One report states that some 6,800 German officers and men have been sent to Russia to bring to Germany 100 submarines built under German supervision in Russian yards for the German Navy. It is certain that Russia possessed at the outbreak of the war upwards of 130 submarines. Perhaps as many as 160. Some of these are in the Far East, but others are certainly in the Baltic. But we are still waiting to learn where and how and even if Germany will begin that ruthless and relentless war of which her leader has warned the world. Perhaps an indication may be seen in the report just in that a squadron of 12 German planes has attacked a convoy of British merchant vessels. This is the first attempt of this sort in the war. The British report claims that 3 German planes were brought down and that none of the merchant vessels or escorting naval vessels were damaged. If true, this will be a discouraging beginning for the Germans in this form of warfare, save that the attack appears to have been beaten off by British shore-based aircraft, and that convoys attacked in less fortunate locations may prove less defensible against air attack. Meanwhile, Mr. Horbalasha, British War Secretary, warns his fellow countrymen against being seduced into listening to specious German peace offers, asserts that if the Germans attack in the West, they will suffer ruinous losses, while Britain must not be lured into attacking prematurely. He describes this war as being not a war about a map, but a struggle between good and evil, which Britain can have no thought of abandoning without achieving her purposes. Thus, while Britain continues resolute but maintains her defensive attitude, on this 51st day of the Second World War, both sides seem committed to a continuance of the struggle. By what means it will be continued, we should soon know.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. And now let's hear from France, a report from Bill Henry in Paris, who has returned from the front for this broadcast. Go ahead, Paris.
During 2 weeks in France, in which I have toured practically all of the widespread establishments of the Royal Air Force, have talked with French soldiers from the Maginot Line. I have, in fact, a souvenir in the form of the Maginot Medal from the Strasbourg area, and have just returned from a visit to the British Army posts. I have learned that the absence of sensational battles has not meant the lack of activity over here. 2 weeks ago, I was able to tell Columbia listeners the strange news that no British fighting plane had yet battled a German plane, although British bombers had engaged in furious fights with the German Messerschmitts. If I said the same thing again tonight, it would still be true, but not for the same reason. 2 weeks ago, there were practically no British fighting planes in France. The British air forces were, at the request of the French, largely light bombers and reconnaissance planes. That is no longer true. In fact, British fighting planes capable of nearly 400 miles an hour and carrying a heavy armament of machine guns have escorted the larger British bombers along the front, have encountered German fighting planes, and the only reason there was no combat was because the Germans declined the issue. A visit to the British Army, in which we ducked and dodged light tanks and trucks and fighting equipment of all sorts along the roads, proved that the 7 weeks of war without fighting in the British sector have been put to good purpose. The British position is rapidly approaching the strength of the Maginot Line, and reinforcements of men and material are arriving all the time. British troops are actually shoulder to shoulder with the French, thus transforming Mr. Chamberlain's fine phrase into an actual physical fact. And the morale of all the Allied troops has been raised by this friendly association on a common front. The visit of Air Minister Sir Kingsley Wood this past week had a fine effect. His trip to the frontline airfields and his fine gesture in visiting not only the French Air Ministry, but also the French fighting squadrons, did much to cement the friendly cooperation between the Allied air forces. As far as the French are concerned, well, they're all right. Frenchmen can get more excited over very little and, by contrast, be more calm in the face of a great emergency than any race I've seen. One of the chaps from the Maginot Line, an infantry officer, described his feelings about the war by saying that Hitler's constant threats were like a bad tooth. You'll put up with it a couple of times if it isn't too bad, but if it shows signs of being chronic trouble, there's nothing to do but to yank it out. He was greatly pleased with the result of the recent activity in the area between the Maginot and Siegfried lines, in which the French had kept by far the greater part of the area, which they took at almost no cost. And the portion which the Germans took back last week in an attack by 30,000 men was regained at enormous cost. The officer said he thought the French would be willing to bargain with Hitler on this same basis until Hitler ran out of both men and munitions. As for us, he said, nous avons beaucoup de temps. We have plenty of time. The absence of fighting, too, has enabled the thrifty French to complete their harvest of grapes in the Champagne region and of sugar beets to the northwest in the regions fairly close to the fighting zone, soldiers having been released to assist in the harvesting. No, as far as the Allies are concerned, this war is going all right. There haven't been many glorious, blood-drenched battles, but if they can win the war this way without wasting men and munitions or devastating the rich countryside, that's certainly a far smarter way to win it than by making history at the expense of lives. We return you now to Columbia in New York.
That was Bill Henry in Paris. Now news from our own nation's capital, which today heard a remarkable statement from North Carolina Senator Robert Reynolds. A further report from Washington now by Albert Warner. We take you now to Washington.
The Senate yields slowly. The administration has just failed in its first effort to limit Senate debate on the neutrality bill. At the end of the afternoon, the majority leader, Mr. Barkley, finding that more speeches were to be made and consideration of amendments not yet started, proposed the limitation. He suggested no senator talk more than 1 hour on the bill and 30 minutes on amendments. When Mr. Barkley asked for unanimous consent for this program, the minority leader, Mr. McNary, objected. The fact is, though he did not state it, that Hiram Johnson, the veteran isolationist, and Pat McCarran, a Democratic ally, registered their opposition. But Senator McNary told Barkley he thought that on Monday an arrangement could be made for limitation on talk, and he congratulated Mr. Barkley on his generous conduct of the proceedings up to date. In spite of this delay, the end of the war of words is in sight. Both Barkley and McNary predicted a final vote would be reached by next Friday. Then the issue will be transferred to the more doubtful mercies of the House. As to the Senate, almost every observer agrees tonight that the bill will be passed and the arms embargo repealed by an overwhelming vote. Senator Burns, a strategist for the administration, tells us that at least 65 of the 96 members of the Senate will vote to end the arms embargo, which now prevents guns and airplanes from going to the belligerents, meaning for all practical purposes Britain and France. A new theory as to the sinking of the British liner Athenia with 300 Americans aboard was advanced by Senator Reynolds, the North Carolina Democrat, today. It wasn't a German submarine. It wasn't a British submarine which was responsible. It was a pirate of the sea sent out by Soviet Russia, the senator declared. While most Americans believe that Germany sank the Athenia, there has not been published a shred of concrete evidence to prove this, Reynolds said. It would have been the height of stupidity for the Germans to have done it, he declared, because the sinking was profitable to the British in inflaming public opinion against Berlin. But he said, I cannot believe that Britain would be so dastardly as to sacrifice American lives and the lives of other nationalities. Thereupon, Reynolds built up what he called a circumstantial case against Russia. It wanted Germany and Britain to wear themselves out, he said. So the alleged Russian sinking of the Athenia at the start of the war stiffened the British backbone by giving London the hope of American support. Reynolds even suggested that the Germans were thinking of a Russian submarine when they warned the United States that the American liner Iroquois was to be sunk. Russia is an ally of Germany, said Reynolds, but what an ally! An ally that would stick its grandmother in the back with a knife without batting an eyelash. When the debate was over for the day, some of us asked Majority Leader Barkley whether he, too, thought Russians had sunk the Athenia. He laughed. That was all. By the way, Konstantin Umansky, the young Russian ambassador to the United States, is at last returning here. Through all the kaleidoscopic changes in Soviet policy, the Russian embassy has been represented here by only a non-English-speaking second or third secretary. Some there were who thought Umansky might never return. In his diplomatic career, he enjoyed the friendly sponsorship of Maxim Litvinov, whose own career as Soviet foreign commissar ended abruptly last spring. That neutrality debate brought up another subject today. Senator Vandenberg feared that the cash-and-carry neutrality program and the Treasury's standing offer to buy all gold at $35 an ounce would bring to the United States all the yellow metal in the world, just to be buried in a hole in the ground in Kentucky, perhaps to become well-nigh useless metal. By the way, some 40 members of the Senate have made speeches now, but the hardiest of them all is Senator Wiley, a Wisconsin Republican. He has listened to every single address. When the floor was otherwise almost deserted, Mr. Wiley was there. He wasn't reading a newspaper, he was actually listening. Today, at last, he was going to make a speech himself, but they squeezed him out. He will have to wait till Monday. The perfect listener, he gave his own purely personal verdict of the talk today. Some of it is analytical, some of it is distinguished, most of it is bunk. That's Wiley's verdict. We return you now to New York.
That was the report in Washington of CBS representative in the nation's capital, Mr. Albert Warner, who was telling us the latest news from Washington, D.C. During this broadcast period, we heard the report first from Berlin of Mr. William L. Shirer, and then we heard London hearing a report there from Edward Murrow. Bill Henry, who just returned from the front for this broadcast, spoke to us from Paris, and then Major George Fielding Elliott gave us a report of the military and naval aspects of the war here in New York. The report from Washington concluded this broadcast period. Just a reminder now that at 8:55 Eastern Time, Columbia brings you the nightly broadcast of Elmer Davis and the news.